This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, Wall Street suffered its worst day since 2008, and while markets seem to be stabilizing a little bit today, the world still holds its collective breath in fear of an even greater economic shock. Many draw comparisons to the free fall that followed the collapse of Lehman Brothers in the fall of 2008, or go back further into economic history, to the panic of 1893, the malaise of 1970s stagflation, or to the Great Depression, when nearly a quarter of the nation was unemployed and the stock market lost almost all its value. But the impact went way beyond pocketbook issues. American families were restructured, hemlines on skirts lengthened, and politics was transformed. In his new book, Don Peck shows how all these economic shocks affected the nation in finances, jobs, and demographics, yes, but also shifts of culture, politics, and the psyche of the nation. Aside from having less money in the bank, call and tell us about the unexpected ways the Great Recession has changed your life. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, our favorite film buff Murray Horowitz on movies about the end of the world. You can email us your favorite post-apocalypse movie now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, the lasting effects of the Great Recession. Don Peck joins us here in Studio 3A. He's a features editor at The Atlantic, where he covers the economy and the American society. His new book is Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Neil.
And at times, over the past few days, it seems a pity we've already used up that panic word as a title for one of these events.
It certainly seems that way, you know, but I think the last few days really confirm for me, and I'm sure for most of your listeners, the sentiment that absent aggressive actions to change things, actions we have not yet been taking, we're nowhere near the end of this period. You know, I think the markets in part were simply ahead of the economy, which has shown very little sign of recovery.
Absent aggressive actions?
Absolutely. You know, there are things we can do to get out of this period, and I cover them quite a lot in my book. But what we're doing now is in some ways the opposite of what we should be doing, in the biggest picture at least. You know, the debt ceiling deal represents the culmination and continuation of several months of turning away from strategies focused on job creation and towards austerity and budget cutting. Yet this deal does it exactly the wrong way. The debt is a problem in the U.S. We need to address it in the long run. We need to do things now to make sure that the debt will be lower once the economy is healthy again. But cutting the deficit in the short run, moving towards austerity right now, is a mistake that we've made again and again in the depths of recession in our history. And it simply doesn't work. I think the market plunges is in some small part at least a referendum on that.
Well, the aforementioned panic of 1893, we didn't have the kind of governmental tools that you're talking about now. We did later in 1929, and President Hoover famously said, no, we need to balance the budget.
Absolutely. And we all know what happened then. There was a secondary crash, though, that I think is maybe even more apt for our times right now. And that's 1937. It's funny, whenever we have a big crash and things turn bearish, people become more money conscious, more conservative, and they become much more concerned about the size of the debt. It's an emotional reaction, and we've seen it again and again. We saw it in the early 80s. We saw it in 1936, too. You know, jobs were still not plentiful in that year, though they were coming back, and people were becoming more and more concerned about years of government debt. A large majority of the population was surveyed as saying the budget absolutely had to be balanced that year. So in 1937, the government raised taxes, cut spending. The market plunged. Unemployment rose again to 19%, and it took five more years to recover.
And really the Second World War, when, of course, deficit spending was all the rage.
That's what got us out of the Depression.
But I wanted to talk, we'll talk more about some of the ways out of the crisis a little bit later, but I wanted to talk about some of the lessons you derive from studies of those previous eras. You write in your book, once the character of a generation is fully formed, it cannot be unformed. Once reactionary sentiments come out of the bottle, they are hard to put back in. can a generation have a character be shaped by these kind of events?
Absolutely. You know, one of the main points of my book is that we think about this recession as a temporary period where, you know, jobs are lost, jobs will be regained, housing values have gone down, they'll go back up. But periods like this one leave lasting changes on the national character, on communities, and as you noted, on the character of generations, particularly generations that are just reaching adulthood. We certainly saw that in the Great Depression. We saw it as well in the 1970s, and we're seeing it today. Economic research indicates that the first few years on the job market are extremely important to establishing one's career path, and that people who come onto the job market for the first time in a bad recession not only start behind, they never catch up. So there's a lifelong financial impact from being stuck and struggling early in your career when employers are forming judgments about you. But beyond that, the character of generations really can change. In the Depression, famously, we came out of that with a generational shift towards thrift. The 1970s undid that. Inflation was the problem, and young boomers learned the opposite lesson, that in fact, thrift was for fools, that debts were the thing to do, that big mortgages made sense because inflation would eat them away. Inflation came down, but that sense and sensibility seemed to remain with boomers throughout their lives. And so from the fruit of one crisis, we've seen the seeds of another.
You mentioned, though, that generation that came out of the 1930s, this is a generation that came of age in 1937, they formed the backbone of the army that liberated Europe and the Pacific. This is what Tom Brokaw dubbed the greatest generation.
It's important,
I think. They weren't pinched.
No. Well, they were at the time, but yeah, they didn't suffer lasting problems. And it's important to kind of separate life stage when thinking about times like these. You know, there's a sociologist, Glenn Elder at North Carolina, who followed various age cohorts throughout their lives after the Depression to see how the Depression changed them. And what he found was for people who were mostly adolescents during the Depression, there were really no lasting scars. In fact, adolescents were counted on for more. They were pampered less. And as you said, there was also, quite happily in a sense, a big event which gave them employment as they were reaching adulthood and put them in good stead for the rest of their lives. So when you look at people who were in their teens during the heart of the Depression, what you see for years afterwards is an orientation towards family, an ability to delay gratification, and many other kind of socially desirable trends. But things were different for people who were in their 20s, primarily during the heart of the Depression. People who really struggled in that age group, and especially men, continued to struggle for years afterwards, after booms and busts, even after they had economically recovered to some extent. They were left, as Elder said, adrift, lacking agency, and lacking confidence in themselves and in their ability to change their fate.
We're talking with Don Peck about his new book, Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. We want to hear about some of the ways beyond those pocketbook issues everybody knows about. Yes, we know you've got less money. Your house is not worth so much anymore. Maybe it's underwater. What are the unusual ways that have surprised you that your life has been affected by the Great Recession? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Doug, and Doug's on the line with us from Portland.
Hi, Neil. I wait tables for a living. I'm closer to 60 than I am to 50. I lost my job at a fancy steakhouse about 6 months ago, and I am lucky enough to be working at a wonderful local restaurant chain in Portland. I am now bicycling to work at least 90% of the time.
And is this an expression of solidarity with the green movement or expression of revulsion at gas prices?
You know, a little bit of both of those. I'm in better shape than I've been in quite a while. It's only 5 miles one way. Actually, once you get into it, you realize it's not that far. And we have a bike trail here that's car-free almost all the way to my job downtown. So I'm loving it. And I am eating out less, which is hard for me in my line of work, but I'm exercising more.
Well, so you've adapted, and do you feel like your future has been pinched?
You know, I've thought about it a couple of times, and I think maybe so. But I'm trying to live in the moment and enjoy life, and I'm doing so, and enjoying my new changes and riding my bike.
Doug, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. And Don Peck, we were talking earlier about younger people. Some of the most drastic effects, though, of these economic crises felt people the caller's age, 50 and over.
Absolutely. And you know, Doug is lucky in a sense that he has a good job right now. Older people have not been thrown out of work in the same numbers that middle-aged and young people have in this recession, which has been one interesting phenomenon. But those who have lost their jobs have been much more deeply troubled in the main than other generations. You know, when someone in their 50s or early 60s loses work, it's very, very hard to find it again. And in my travels around the country and my reporting, you know, I met any number of people who thought they were near retirement, who've been out of work for a year, 2 years. I talked to one former financial analyst, Gus Polos, near Philadelphia.
I had my page open to page 20 right here.
Gus kind of did everything right in life. He was a Vietnam era veteran. He put himself through night school. He became a financial analyst, lost his job, now going on 2.5 years ago, and just hasn't been able to find anything since then. He's found part-time work at Walmart. And that's all. Now, the financial burden of that has been hard, but Gus's wife is still working. That's a blessing. The main problems that he seems to have are psychological, involving a loss of status, identity, a sense of loss of self, and I think we see that throughout the economy today.
Recently, he'd gotten a part-time job as a cashier at Walmart for $8.50 an hour. They say, "Do you want it?" In my head, I thought, "No," and I raised my hand and said, "Yes." That a quote from Gus Poulos in the book, Pinched. The author, Don Peck, is with us. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Economic shocks can change a nation. Culture and politics do not respond uniformly. No matter when a slump ends, we live with the changes for decades. Extended unemployment, says author Don Peck, can create a sense of crippling disorientation, leaving people isolated and frustrated and just plain beat down. Peck spoke with one man, Gus, who went from a financial analyst to a part-time clerk. You can read Gus's story in an excerpt at our from his book, Pinched, on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Aside from the dwindling balance in your bank account, what are the unexpected ways the Great Recession has changed your life? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. James is on the line. James with us from Phoenix.
Hey there. I'm one of the younger generation you were talking about earlier, in my early 20s. I happened to start my college experience at the same time this recession started to kick in, and it really helped guide the path I was going to take in college. I've been studying economics and mathematics for the last couple of years, and it's very interesting on the effects that it's had on my political standpoints. Coming out of high school, I defined myself as a staunch libertarian, and nowadays, I actually define myself as quite the opposite. I define myself as a socialist.
Well, people have been known to change their political orientation in college before.
Well, yeah, but this is definitely because of how I've seen the effects of capitalism on the economy. In fact, we're seeing an economy that is growing less and less, and we're seeing a larger disparity of the wealth, and one can say that it's the private ownership of property that is what's causing this.
James, and how do you manifest your socialist tendencies?
Well, I vote for the Socialist Party, interestingly enough. I even write in on ballots when they're not in elections, but I try to keep people informed. Every day when I'm talking to people, I talk about them, about cognitive differences, how laziness is something that's a product of the system as opposed to a product of individuals. Talking about things such as the public ownership of companies, where the workers own their companies, is actually more intuitive to productivity, seeing as though they see a direct benefit from all of the work that they put in, as opposed to these hand downs from essentially their masters. I find it very interesting, this strange love of capitalism that we're holding on to, seeing as though our country is not defined as a capitalistic country. In fact, many of the ideas of property ownership were left out of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence specifically for that reason, seeing as though the Founding Fathers saw the failings of certain economic systems and wanted to give us the power to change our economic ideals.
Well, James, thanks very much for the call and appreciate the lecture. Bye-bye. Done.
Yeah, James. You know, your story goes a bit further than most of the conversations I've had with people your age around the country. But you're by no means alone. You know, one thing that has happened reliably in past recessions is that young people have become more liberal politically. They've become more cognizant of the role plays of the role luck plays in life. Though they've also become less confident in the government as a competent actor. So, kind of a complicated set of effects that we've seen in past recessions. And from my conversations and from your own story, you know, I think we are seeing that again. And again, if this period is like those others, these changed set of ideals will last. They will be with young people for the rest of their lives. You know, I want to make one comment on what you were saying, James, about, you know, our capitalist system and what it can and cannot do. You know, I think certainly in the mid-20th century, there was a sense that the forces of capitalism, you know, constrained by government in meaningful ways, but capitalism itself was improving the plight of nearly all Americans. Everyone was getting ahead. And one thing that this recession has really emphasized is how much the path of technology, the path of globalization, the path of our own economy have changed that. The middle class has been hollowing out for years, but that hollowing has been accelerated meaningfully during this recession. People who have found work again, who have lost middle class jobs, tend to be working in low wage jobs. And so I also hear, and with good reason, more and more questions about, you know, whether the middle class can be saved coming out of this period and over the next decade or two.
There are also, you document, during the 1930s, during the Great Depression, people thought the capitalist system as it existed then was a documented failure. You saw a couple of different reactions to that in terms of greater popularity of the Communist Party, greater popularity of the attraction of fascism, but not the kind of reactionary response that you documented we saw in the Panic of 1893 and indeed in 1970.
The Depression was unusual in that it tended to bring people together more than in most deep downturns. And that may simply be a result of the fact that the pain was so deep and so widely spread that it did really inspire kind of some communal thinking. The middle class identified with the poor rather than the rich. You know, what we've seen in this recession is different. You know, that an iconic image in the Depression was of a banker selling apples on a street corner. You know, patently that's not the case today. This recession seems to be pulling us apart by class, both economically and culturally.
Let's go next to Nikki. Nikki on the line with us from Hell in Michigan.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
The biggest change that I have experienced is a little bit of my background. I graduated high school from a great middle class society town in 1995. I graduated with a bachelor's in science education in 2002 from Eastern Michigan University, and I taught, and my husband and I got married and took on a mortgage in October of 2009, and in June of 2010, I'm out of teaching, and I can't afford to keep my continuing credits up. So all of a sudden, here I am, 33 years old, and I have to change careers. I thought I was going to be a teacher till the day I died. And there's no space in teaching for me unless I leave Michigan, which I can't afford to do.
And so now
I'm going back to school. I'm back to school with 18 and 20-year-olds, and I'm going to be trained in a certificate school for a medical assisting program.
Well,
and so here I am changing fields in my mid-30s, and I thought for sure that I'd been, you know, almost achieved tenure in a school by now.
And that is a situation. We've all seen the statistics on if you go to college and get a degree, you're going to be, on average, much better off. But there are whole parts of the country, and Don, you talk about this in the book, that are doing so much better than other parts. And Michigan, of course, is everybody knows, is on the short end of that stick.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to just underline your point on college. You know, there's been a lot of commentary lately that college may not be worth it anymore. We saw the exact same thing during the Depression. People really began to question whether a college degree made sense. It's a product of these particular times and this particular pain. In general, there is no evidence whatsoever that the value of a college degree is declining. It seems to be increasing, but the geographic point is a really important one today. You know, the neither the recession nor especially the recovery has been even. If you look at the power centers and creative enclaves of the U.S., Washington D.C., the San Francisco Bay Area, Boston to some extent, Raleigh-Durham, you know, these are places that have been recovering. You know, the housing bust was not as severe to begin with. Unemployment was not as severe to begin with, and jobs are coming back. Meanwhile, places like much of Michigan and many of the former middle-class meccas in the Sun Belt, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Tampa, have really been struggling. And I think one thing we need to do as we think about recovery from this recession is to actively help people who are stuck in those extremely depressed places move to places where there are more work opportunities. You know, those places aren't just high-cost areas like Manhattan. You know, Baltimore, Minneapolis, these are places that are getting healthy again. The unemployment rate in Minneapolis is about half what it is in Las Vegas.
Nikki, thanks very much. Good luck.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. Let's go next to, this is Dana, and Dana's on the line with us from Columbus.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, I wanted to contribute. My fiancé and I are in our 20s, and we are going on almost a three-year engagement. And I wanted to talk about, you had said something about the hems of skirts got higher and social mores kind of left. And we have found that our very conservative Irish Catholic families have kind of looked past the idea of us even getting married anymore because of the money. And they've encouraged us to go ahead and start a family.
Hmm.
Again, you're describing an increasingly common phenomenon. You know, what we know is when times are hard and jobs uncertain, especially male jobs. Women tend not to marry those men, but recent history shows us that they do have children with them. So family structure and family patterns usually change in periods like this, and they are quite clearly changing today. More people are having children before getting married or in the absence of getting married, and many people are also delaying childbirth. So we're likely to come out of this period, I think, with smaller families, with a lower rate of marriage, and you know, that can certainly not in every case. You know, parenthood absent marriage can be a terrific solution for a lot of people, but in the main, when people have children out of wedlock, those partnerships tend not to last. And
statistically, we're not talking about you.
We're not talking about you. You know, so one of the problems that I think about a lot that could endure beyond this recession is we're seeing a lot of children being born into single-parent households. And we know from experience that those children do tend to struggle over time. So in various ways, and family structure is only one of them, you know, the longer this period stretches on, the more we're likely to see, you know, problems for young children as they grow up.
Dana, thanks very much.
Thank you.
By the way, next Thursday in this hour, we're going to be featuring a book called Cracking the New Job Market with more advice on how to find work. It's not exactly the subject we're talking about today. We're talking with Don Peck about his book, Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's go next to John, and John's with us from Vallejo in California.
Hi, Neil. I've noticed I'm a utility worker, and I've noticed that my friends who have kept their jobs are working many, many, many more hours. I have not worked under 60 hours a week in months, and neither have most of my employed friends. And so we don't really have time for socializing. And when we do socialize, it's usually something simpler, kind of an ad hoc get-together that's respectful of the fact that many of our peers don't have jobs. So there's no more dinners for 15 people at the nice restaurant, you know, on your birthday or anything like that. So the people who have the money, we don't have the time to spend it. So I don't see how we're going to get pulled out of this thing if no one's spending money.
Well, that's it's another issue. But the socializing aspect that he's talking about, indeed, you talk about the isolation that is caused by economic hard times.
That's right. I mean, for people who have lost jobs for very different reasons, there is a withdrawal typically from society. There's a recent study by Rutgers of people who'd been unemployed for more than 7 months, and what it showed was that more than half were withdrawing from their friends. More than half reported family conflict. Social networks shrink. People become poorer, so they can't go out, and they become embarrassed, so they don't socialize as much. And this leaves both psychological scars and it changes in people in ways that can make it harder for them to find work again. You know, one of the main ways of finding a new job is through your own social networks. And as those networks deteriorate, joblessness can become a self-reinforcing problem.
John, thanks very much for the call. And give yourself a break. Take a vacation. Spend some money.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. I wanted to ask you, we started talking about prescriptions. You said more aggressive, smarter government action. We're, though, in a period where it seems some of the reactionary political movements you describe in the past, that seems to have come into American politics, too, this time around.
Yes, politics become meaner typically as recessions stretch beyond just a couple of years, and aggressive action, bold action, becomes harder. Sentiment towards immigrants tends to deteriorate. Support for the poor tends to deteriorate. People become more jealous of their status relative to others and more cynical about what the government can accomplish. And I think we are seeing that now, and it makes the solutions to our problems, you know, all the more difficult. But you know, there are a number of things that I think, you know, we can agree on as Americans. You know, people will agree, people will disagree about fiscal stimulus. There are certain categories of spending that just make a ton of sense today. Infrastructure spending is one. You know, our infrastructure in the U.S. has deteriorated badly. We've been underinvesting for years.
Bridges, highways, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And we spend, as a percent of our economy, about half of what Europe does, about a third of what China does. So, you know, there is no better. So this is an investment. It's not merely spending. And it's a great way of creating jobs immediately for people who are in construction, people who are in manufacturing, and people who have been hardest hit by this recession.
As you look ahead, though, the will to generate that kind of money, to spend that kind of money, to raise the income, it just doesn't seem to be there.
Right now it isn't. And I hope, you know, one of the messages of my book, I suppose, is that it should be.
you can exhort all you want. It's not going to get a bill passed in Congress.
No, and you know, countries can fall into political traps in periods like this, where it simply becomes harder and harder to get anything done, and we're really seeing a lot of that. You know, I think people are I talked to some people who are afraid of a rising populism, demagoguery. I think the larger risk is just endless vacillation and switching between parties, and politicians who are afraid to do anything because they're afraid of the next election.
Dow Jones Industrial Average up 117 points. So there's some positive news. Don Peck, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Don Peck, features editor at The Atlantic. His book is Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. And now, as the dog days set in, it's time for TOTN Summer Movie Festival. Up next, The Apocalypse.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time's here.
Hide under your desk, shut your windows, and email us your favorite post-apocalyptic movie, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.